stars and stripes. Dumpster fire vibe. Come on. All American why? All American why? All American why? Ask yourself the American why.
Hello, excessive thinkers. Today we're asking a question that exposes a national hypocrisy. Why is a nation built by immigrants still so afraid of immigrants? From the very beginning, immigration in America has never been accidental. It has been shaped by economic need, political fear, racial hierarchy, and selective memory, often all at the same time. And before we go any further, we need to say this plainly. Unless you are indigenous to this land, you are here because someone immigrated. That is not a metaphor, that is history. Native people did not immigrate here. They were already here. Long before the United States existed, indigenous nations built complex civilizations, governance systems, economies, and vast trade networks. They developed sophisticated agricultural practices, land stewardship methods, medicine, engineering, and systems of knowledge that settlers relied on to survive. Native people taught Europeans how to grow crops like corn, beans, and squash, and how to navigate rivers and terrain, how to be more effective when they fished, how to survive unfamiliar climates, and how to manage land sustainably. Much of what became American agriculture, food systems, and environmental knowledge came directly from indigenous expertise. What followed was not immigration, it was genocide and removal. Indigenous populations were decimated by violence, forced displacement, broken treaties, boarding schools, and the intentional or reckless spread of European diseases like smallpox, measles, and influenza. Some outbreaks were the result of contact, others were weaponized, all were catastrophic. This wasn't a theory or series of isolated actions, it was the law, it was policy, it was power. In 1830, our United States Congress passed the Indian Removal Act, authorizing the federal government to forcibly remove indigenous nations from their ancestral lands east of the Mississippi River. Entire nations were displaced through coercion, deception, and military force. Families were marched hundreds of miles under armed guard, often with little food, shelter, or medical care. This policy led directly to mass death, most infamously during the Trail of Tears, an atrocity that, like slavery, is often reduced to a brief, sanitized version of history. In reality, an estimated 10,000 to 15,000 indigenous people, a conservative figure, including Cherokee, Muscogee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, and Seminole people died from exposure, starvation, and disease during forced removal. Across the Americas, an estimated 40 to 55 million indigenous people died as a result of colonization. Broken treaties, forced relocations, and boarding schools were not accidents. They were federal policy. Immigration into the United States occurred alongside the active removal of Native people from their land. That context matters because it tells us something essential. Who gets to belong has always been enforced by law and power. For everyone else, arrival took many forms. Some came willingly, some fled by war or famine, some were recruited for labor, and some did not come by choice at all. I am named after my great-grandmother, Molly Scher, who came through Ellis Island. After much of her family was killed in front of her, she worked as a seamstress and waited 2 years for her ship to arrive. When she crossed the ocean, she entered a system that decided, often in minutes, whether she was allowed to stay. From the very beginning, immigration has been the engine of American growth. Immigrants built the farms that fed the country. They built the railroads that connected it. They built the factories that powered industrialization. They built cities, ports, canals, roads, schools, and hospitals. Again, though, not everyone came by choice. Enslaved Africans were forcibly brought to what is now the United States. They did not immigrate. They were kidnapped, transported across the Atlantic, sold as property, and brutally exploited. Millions endured starvation, disease, and violence during transport. Between 1500 and 1866, an estimated 12.5 million Africans were forcibly taken to the Americas through the transatlantic slave trade. Approximately 1.8 million died during the Middle Passage alone. Their labor generated enormous wealth that the United States still benefits from today. Banks, universities, plantations, railroads, the capital, entire industries were built on forced migration. You cannot talk about American prosperity without talking about slavery. And this is where I think about one of the most honest places I've ever stood. The National Museum of African American History and Culture in DC. One of my favorite exhibits there, and I say favorite not because it excites me, but because it tells the truth, is called The Paradox of Liberty. That exhibit forces you to confront a contradiction we are usually taught to smooth over. The same nation that declared all men are created equal was simultaneously enslaving millions of people. The same founders who wrote about liberty, freedom, and natural rights owned human beings and profited from forced labor. The exhibit does not let you separate those truths. American democracy and American bondage were built at the same time, by the same people, and under the same laws. Liberty for some, enforced unfreedom for others, ideals on paper, violence in practice. That paradox is not just history, it is a pattern. Other groups were recruited and then discarded. For example, Chinese immigrants were brought to build the Transcontinental Railroad. Once the work was done, they were blamed for economic instability. In 1882, the United States passed the Chinese Exclusion Act, banning Chinese laborers entirely. It was the first federal law to exclude a group based on race and nationality. Irish immigrants were portrayed as violent. Italians, Jews, Poles, and Eastern Europeans were framed as biologically inferior. Overcrowding, disease, crime, and moral decay were blamed on newcomers. Every major period of American expansion has relied on immigrants, and every one of them has been followed by panic. This is not a contradiction, it is the pattern. From railroads to factories, from agriculture to technology, the United States has repeatedly invited labor without inviting belonging. Immigrants are welcome when they are useful, invisible, and compliant. And fear resurfaces the moment they are seen as permanent, political, or human. That pattern did not disappear during World War II. It was merely interrupted by necessity. World War II disrupted the usual cycle of exclusion, not because xenophobia faded, but because the economy could not function without immigrant labor. With millions of American men drafted and domestic labor stretched thin, the federal government turned to Mexico to fill roles it openly described as essential. The result was the Bracero program, or Bracero program, launched in 1942, which recruited millions of Mexican laborers to work in agriculture and on the railroads, jobs deemed critical to food production and wartime infrastructure. These workers were never framed as future Americans. They were framed as temporary solutions to an economic problem. The program promised fair wages, adequate housing, medical care, labor protections, and basic dignity. Yet in practice, many precarios experienced wage theft, unsafe and substandard housing, withheld pay that was never returned, dangerous working conditions, and retaliation for speaking out. Oversight of this program was weak and enforcement inconsistent, and their temporary status meant complaints could cost them their livelihood or lead to deportation. Participation did not provide a path to permanent residency or citizenship, no matter how many seasons they worked or how essential their labor proved to be. This contradiction sits at the heart of U.S. immigration policy. Mexican labor was welcomed. Mexican people were not. The system was designed to extract value without granting rights. Immigrants were expected to work, obey, and leave, but not to stay, organize, vote, put down roots, or claim equality. Belonging was never the goal. Productivity was. When the Precario program ended in 1964, the labor demand did not disappear. Farms still needed workers, railroads still needed labor, and food production still depended on immigrant hands. What disappeared was the legal pathway. When lawful channels closed while economic demand remained, unauthorized migration increased. Workers became more vulnerable and fear was redirected at the very people the system actually relied on. The problem was not immigration. The problem was policy designed to end responsibility without ending dependence. Once labor scarcity eased, the familiar cycle resumed. Fear once again overrode rights. Immigrants were reframed as threats rather than contributors. Enforcement replaced accommodation. And punishment replaced policy. The very same workers, once labeled essential, became illegal, undesirable, and a problem to be solved. This is not an accident of history. It is the consequence of a system that treats immigrants as inputs rather than neighbors. After the United States was attacked at Pearl Harbor in 1941 by the Empire of Japan, more than 120,000 Japanese Americans, along with others who were deemed to, and I'm holding up my hands for air quotes, look Japanese, were forcibly removed from their homes and imprisoned in government-run camps. Nearly two-thirds of those incarcerated were actually U.S. citizens. And by the way, the 14th Amendment clearly states that people born here are U.S. citizens. Full stop. Families during these internment times lost homes, farms, businesses, and lifetimes of work in a matter of days. There was no evidence of widespread espionage. There was no individualized suspicion. Guilt was assigned by race or by the perception of race alone. And citizenship did not protect them. Decades later, the government apologized, but the precedent remained. Fear can suspend rights, and regret after the fact doesn't undo harm. That precedent matters because it did not end with the camps. It became part of the way the United States responds to a perceived threat and mirrors exactly what is happening now. The modern asylum system was formalized in 1980 with the Refugee Act, not as a loophole, but as a legal obligation under both U.S. and international law. Asylum exists precisely because history showed what happens when fear overrides protection. And yet, refugee policy has never been applied evenly. Some groups are welcomed as deserving. Others are framed as dangerous, fraudulent, or expendable. In 1965, the Immigration and Nationality Act abolished race-based quotas and reshaped modern immigration through family reunification. Some groups are welcomed as deserving. Others are framed as dangerous, fraudulent, or expendable. In 1965, the Immigration and Nationality Act abolished race-based quotas and reshaped modern immigration through family reunification and employment, creating the framework we still live in under today. But law alone does not guarantee justice. Implementation reflects politics, fear, and selective empathy. And here is the quiet truth we do not say out loud enough. The United States has not passed comprehensive immigration reform in decades. Instead, we have a patchwork system built on outdated assumptions, political fear, and intentional neglect. Visa caps froze while the population grew. Backlogs stretched from years into decades. People were told to do it the right way, even when the right way meant waiting longer than a childhood lasts. Programs like H-2A, H-2B, and H-1B exist because the U.S. economy depends on immigrant labor. Agriculture, construction, hospitality, food processing, landscaping, caregiving, janitorial work, meatpacking, warehousing, tech, healthcare, airport jobs of every type, year-long hospitality, and seasonal tourism. These are not abstract jobs. These are the jobs that keep this country running. But these programs are narrow, temporary, and fragile by design. Workers are tied to single employers. Lose the job, lose the status. Challenge exploitation, risk deportation. Under the Trump administration, these programs were not eliminated, but they were reshaped through restriction, deterrence, and fear. Denials increased, audits expanded, enforcement pressure intensified, instability became policy. And here's the part that people dance around. I do not know a single white American who talks tough about immigration who would last a full week working 12 hours a day in a field in 100-degree heat. I do not know one white person or white American who wants to pick strawberries at dawn, clean hotel rooms until their hands crack, gut chickens on a processing line, or haul concrete on a construction site with no benefits and no safety net. If immigration opponents truly believed these were easy jobs Americans would take, we would see them lined up for them. We don't see that. So maybe the real test is simple. Put Stephen Miller or Kristi Noem in a field for a few days. No cameras, or maybe some cameras to prove that they were there. No staff, same hours, same pay, same risk. Let us see how long the rhetoric lasts when the labor is real. I still think about a meme from 2016. It said, "You say that they are all criminals and rapists, and they're taking our jobs. So which job did they take from you? Are you a criminal or a rapist?" It is blunt, it is uncomfortable, and it exposes the lie at the center of the fear. Because the truth is this: immigrants are not taking jobs Americans want. They are doing the jobs Americans rely on, but refuse to do. And this raises a question we almost never ask. What if we built clear, humane, durable legal pathways for the industries we already know are understaffed? Healthcare is one of the clearest examples. Hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and home care systems across the country face severe shortages. Nurses, medical assistants, home health aides, long-term care workers. Immigrants already do this work. Many are trained. Many are credentialed elsewhere. Many are stuck in limbo, unable to fully use their skills or advance. What if immigration policy aligned with reality instead of fear? By reality, I mean humanity, decency, and the undeniable fact that immigration is directly tied to the United States' economic survival. The chaos we see is not a flaw in the system. It is the system. The courts upheld it. Congress avoided fixing it. And by the time Donald Trump took office, the enforcement machinery was already in place. He did not invent it, he exploited it. In 2024, a bipartisan immigration and border bill was negotiated in the Senate. Trump publicly urged Republicans to block it, arguing that passage would politically benefit the sitting president, Joe Biden. Republican leadership complied, and the bill died. Reform was not impossible, it was deliberately stopped. And while politicians rail against immigrants, billionaires quietly profit. Entire industries depend on immigrant labor. Fortunes are built on the backs of immigrant workers, then used to fund fear campaigns against the very people who make that wealth possible. Donald Trump's own businesses were no exception. Investigations found that his properties, including Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey, employed undocumented workers using false Social Security numbers and green cards, that managers were aware of their status, and that workers were paid while payroll taxes and Social Security contributions were avoided. And now the hypocrisy has gone even further. And this is where the paradox of liberty stops being a museum exhibit and becomes a living policy choice. Calling people who believe in human decency and are expressing their First Amendment rights domestic terrorists is also shaping out to be a policy choice. An insane choice, but a choice. We tell ourselves slavery, indigenous removal, and Japanese incarceration were failures of a less enlightened past. But the structure never disappeared, the language changed, the targets changed, the tools modernized. Liberty is still promised in theory, while exclusion is still enforced in practice. Modern immigration enforcement operates inside the same paradox. Rights on paper, force in real life, due process in principle, punishment in execution. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, was created in 2003 as part of the post-9/11 reorganization that formed the Department of Homeland Security, folding immigration enforcement into a national security framework rather than a civil regulatory one. ICE was designed to prioritize detention, surveillance, and removal, not humanitarian protection. And over time, it has expanded with limited oversight, routine civil rights violations, and a growing death toll. ICE did not make the immigration system safer or more functional. It made it more punitive, opaque, and deadly, while failing to address the economic realities that drive migration. Abolishing ICE is about dismantling a militarized enforcement apparatus and replacing it with a system rooted in due process, labor protections, and lawful pathways that actually align with the law, human dignity, and public safety. ICE now operates far beyond the border. Agents pull people from cars. They use pepper balls, pepper sprays, and chemical irritants. They break windows, they tackle individuals, and they're murdering people. On January 7th, 2026, in Minneapolis, 37-year-old Renee Nicole Good, a U.S. citizen, mother of three, poet, and community member, was fatally shot by an ICE agent during a federal enforcement operation. Her killing was at least 16 known incidents in which immigration agents fired weapons during enforcement operations in a single year. In 2025, at least 32 people died while in ICE custody, making it the deadliest year for immigration detention in more than two decades. In the first 10 days of 2026 alone, at least four more people died in ICE detention. And unfortunately and disgustingly, this is just the beginning of their exorbitantly funded craziness. What we see on video is not the whole system. It is the part that we happen to catch. And when 60 Minutes won't show you what is going on in detention centers because it may offend the man-child or man-children in the White House, or billionaires who own media conglomerations, what is going on in America? So when we ask why a nation built by immigrants is still so afraid of immigrants, we're not really asking about borders. We may be asking, why the hell are we treating our brothers and sisters like this? It doesn't seem very Judeo-Christian or patriotic. And that is why today's conversation matters. Danny Quach has lived in the United States for more than 40 years and has been in an ICE detention facility in Houston, Texas for 4 months. Today, I'm talking to his wife, Mary, and his good friend, Al.
Hey, Al. Thanks for doing this podcast.
You bet.
Can you tell everyone that's listening what your name is and what you do for your occupation and community?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Al Nodarse, and I was formerly the executive director of Faithful Friends. I'm about to launch another nonprofit that basically focuses on helping nonprofits grow their revenue, because that's my background from a corporate standpoint. But I also consult with socially responsible corporations. Long story short, I love to help people who care about others and try to make the world a better place.
Mm-hmm. And we're here to talk today about your friend Danny. And sort of the overarching question is, why is a nation that is built by immigrants so afraid of immigrants? For listeners who have never heard Danny's name before, how would you describe who he is as a person and not as a case or headline?
Yeah, Danny's a really good man. You know, I only met him about 15 years ago when they moved here to the Northwest. Ironically, they grew up in Houston. Danny and Mary did, just like I did, but we didn't meet till he was here. And he's just one of these guys. I mean, they own the Happy Sparrow Bakery that used to be in Belmont in Portland, and then they moved to Lake Oswego for 15 years. And you walk in and they smile, you know, and they say hi, and they're just very genuine, caring, loving people, you know, just a good dude. Happens to be a strong man of faith. I always joke because he drove this Ford Excursion, which is the biggest truck you can get. And he had this giant sticker that says powered by Jesus, you know, which you see a lot in Texas, but you don't see here in Portland. So just a super strong man of faith, but not in a bad way. You know, he wasn't like your Ned Flanders guy that's like throwing stuff down their throat. I mean, you wouldn't even know he was strong in faith. I kind of compare that to Mr. Rogers, you know. I mean, just good, caring person that's just really, really compassionate.
Yeah, absolutely. And how did you end up meeting Danny, getting to know him and his family?
Yeah, it's funny because I own my own business in the Belmont area, and I was just going for a little drive around lunchtime, and there's this pastry that's really popular in Texas. It's called a kolache, and it's kind of like a pizza pocket. You know, imagine a little pizza pocket. It's got sausage, egg, and cheese and stuff like that. And if you go to Texas, they're huge. You can go to any donut shop, any convenience store, anywhere, and everyone has kolaches. It started in Eastern Texas, and it's from the Czech Republic originally. So when they came out here, they started a kolache shop, and I was so excited because there was no kolache shops in the Pacific Northwest. The closest one was in Orange County in California. And I was just like, oh my gosh, you guys make kolache? So I walked in there, and Danny and Mary were painting the building. I didn't realize this until about a month ago that they had just opened when I first met them. So we just got to know each other really well. At the time, my son was about 8 years old. And my son, his first real job was working for Danny and Mary at the Happy Sparrow when he was 16. I knew Danny and Mary before they had kids. You know, now their kids are 11 and 9 respectively. So we just had a great relationship, been kind of a mentor to him with his business and just great friends. And that's how we met.
That's great. Thanks for sharing that with me. It sounds like you've known him for over a decade or so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about 17 years.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, almost 2 decades. So when you had heard that he had been detained, what was your first reaction?
It was crazy because I got a text from Mary over the weekend, and she says, first thing she says is, Al, this is not a joke. Danny is in a detention facility. And I was just like, you got to be kidding me. How is this possible? I mean, I knew his story. I knew he came over as a refugee, 8-month-old baby from Vietnam 50 years ago. And we know about all that's going on with the Trump administration, but I just never thought this could happen to Danny. It just kind of blew me away because he's such a good citizen. He's a business owner. He's been in this country for 50 plus years. He pays his taxes. You know, he's just, you know, when you hear these headlines that they're all criminals and thugs, and that's the farthest thing from that with Danny, and also the people that he's been talking to inside the facility.
And do you know how they took him and where they took him from?
Yeah. So what happened was they were here in the greater Portland area. Danny's dad was diagnosed with brain cancer. So the kids were born and raised here, and they reluctantly sold the business. They didn't want to. They didn't want to move, but they thought it'd be best to be close to grandpa. So they moved to Houston area. And every 6 months, since he has a green card, he's been checking in. And he's been doing this for 30 plus years with no incidents. And he went in there, but before going, some of his friends were saying, "Hey, bro, you sure you really want to go? There's a lot going on with his eye stuff." And he's such a strong man of faith, and he has such character. He goes, "I got nothing to hide." You know, he goes, "And if there's something that comes up, then, you know, I'll deal with it." So he went there, and right there and then they detained him immediately.
And that was at the airport? In Houston?
No, it was at the ICE facility. The immigration facility in the Houston area that he goes to every 6 months.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Okay. And it sounds like he was there to follow the rules that they had asked him to follow, and they used it as an opportunity to detain him. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it is. And now I just read an article that a lot of folks aren't going, you know, for their check-ins right now, or any legal court proceedings because they're so scared of being detained. But this was on the 18th was December 18th was 90 days that he's been there, you know? So back then it was kind of a newer thing. You know, people didn't really start hearing about those stories. You know, I think they'd just gotten to Los Angeles at that time. Of course, a lot has happened since then, but yeah, it was a new thing back then.
What has this experience revealed to you about the immigration system and how it treats long-term residents and families? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, my story is my dad, you know, fled Cuba in the early 60s and actually late 50s. So I'm an immigrant. I didn't learn English until I was 5 years old. So I've always been really empathetic to the immigration community and helped support entrepreneurs, speaking Spanish, teaching classes, things like that. So when I heard about this happening and really what's added a lot of color is my conversations with Danny. I'm blessed that I get to talk to him every week. They're limited to just a 45-minute phone call, but he's telling me every week about different immigrants and what's going on. And when I start hearing from him, because he's kind of become a de facto minister at his facility, and he's getting to know so many people from all over the world, is he says, "Al, you know," he says, "only about 1-2% of these folks in here are criminals and thugs, you know." And he's in a facility that has 1,500 people, which is one of four in the Houston area. So 6,000 people being detained just right in that area. And we've seen studies in Chicago, you know, where I think it was 2-3%. So you start hearing these stories, you know, and what I tell people is, you know, we're all immigrants. Unless we're Native American, we are all immigrants. And I think that's less than 2% of the population. So 98% of us came here at one time. And I think, and I share some of these stories that Danny shares with me. I have a lot of friends in Texas that are super Trump supporters, and we still love and respect each other. We agree to disagree. But when they start hearing these stories about how they're being treated and what's going on, they even say, "Bro, this is messed up. This is wrong. This is un-American." Some are even former vets. And they say, "We didn't even treat our prisoners this way when we captured them." You know, so it's just the most un-American thing I've ever experienced. You know, I'm 61 years old and I've never been so disappointed in the way our country is treating its citizens.
Thank you for sharing that. And it's good that you and Danny get to talk. What has he talked to you about usually, or how is he doing? Does he explain to you what it's like being in the detention facility?
Yeah, he does, but he's not a complainer. He's a half full kind of guy. So he feels that there's a reason that he's there, but he has shared that they eat beans for lunch and dinner. They only get a 1 hour visit per week. And you know, I won't go into the whole rabbit hole story, but he was, you know, he pled guilty to a firing of a gun in a park when he was 18. Nobody was shot or hit, and he ended up being arrested, and he did 6 years time for that. So when he was in prison for 6 years, the food, the conditions, the visiting hours were so much better than what it is right now. But he focuses most of his time talking to me about people that he's met, you know, and telling their stories. And I'll be more happy to share some of those if you're interested. But he's just so upset with hearing, you know, these stories. And he feels so blessed that he has a community, and we have a GoFundMe campaign. He has all these people. He has family in Vietnam that are ready to receive him. He feels like he's so much better off than 99% of the people that are in there. They're just lost. They don't speak the language. Their family members are scared to come visit them because they'll get detained. They're so alone and their stories are not being told.
Hmm. Yeah, it sounds like he's serving as a source of strength for the other people that are there that he's meeting, which is, you know, maybe a silver lining, a small silver lining in this.
Yeah, it's commendable because I tell people I don't know how I'd react. I'd be pretty angry and bitter if I was in there. And the fact that he's making lemonade out of this, and he says, Al, there's a plan here. God has a plan. And he goes, it's probably bigger than I can imagine. So it's crazy. I mean, he's met people from all over the world, you know, from Panama and Venezuela and China and Taiwan. And as they get deported, Mary, his wife, has captured their contact info, and he's keeping in touch with these folks, you know, and he's planning to teach them, if he has to, how to make kolaches in other parts of the world, you know, and impact them. So he sees this as a global platform. And even now, I mean, he may get released or deported today. It's possible. But he says, if I stay longer, then there's a reason. There's other folks that I need to connect with and help and guide, you know. So he has just been so stoic, and Mary's the same way too. When you talk to her, you'll see just how amazing she is too. They're handling it so well.
Mm-hmm. If you could talk directly about people who feel afraid of immigrants, you know, in 2016 there was a meme, probably based on something Trump said, but it was that you know, they're rapists and criminals, but they're stealing our jobs. And the meme said, so what are you, a rapist or a criminal? And I mean, a lot of these people are, you know, one, all different races and come from all different backgrounds, but many of them are working, paying taxes, part of the community. Can you just speak to maybe this fear? Why are we afraid of immigrants? Or why is there such an othering going on? Kind of your viewpoint on that.
Yeah, I think the fear part is, and you even see this in political circles, you know, most of my liberal friends don't have conservative friends. Most of my conservative friends don't have liberal friends. We tend to try to surround ourselves with people that are similar. And you even see that, you know, culturally. I know you've lived in the Los Angeles area, and you go to Glendale, you have all the Armenians together and the Koreans in certain areas, and we kind of hang out together. And it goes down to me, you know, what I tell people is, you know, we need to seek to understand versus being understood. And I really learned a lot. Well, we owned a home in Santa Barbara, and we had a guest in a guest house, and we're remodeling each one at a time so we could live on one of the houses. And we had a crew there, and as you can imagine, most of the construction crew are Latino. And every Friday, I'd buy them lunch, and we'd sit at the deck of my house, and I'd start hearing their stories. And this is after 9/11. And it was just so sad because even though my mom's from Mexico, dad's from Cuba, we go to Mexico every year, you know, I was still learning so much, you know. And I start hearing these stories of a gentleman who's like 50 years old, whose dad is really ill. And he wants to go back and say goodbye to his father, but he's scared he can't get back across the border. You know, you hear of all these dads, men, you know, that are away from their kids, that have seen their kids grow up, you know. And I've always, every immigrant I've ever met, and I mean, there's thousands of them I've met, most of them don't want to be here, you know, year round. Okay. They're just here because there's an opportunity for them to make more money, and they're destitute. But who would want to leave their wife and kids and their grandparents and everybody behind? And I've been in houses. I remember in Santa Barbara walking in a house. It was a 2,500 square foot house, two stories. And I was there's a young man I was mentoring in there. And picture a living room that's like 30 foot by 20 foot. All right. And in there was 30 sleeping bags. And there was 30 Latino men sleeping in that house. And they're all paying $300 to $400 per month for that little bitty spot. And they all shared one bathroom. So if you just start understanding and you realize, you know, whether they're washing dishes, whether they're doing the garden in your house, whether they're cleaning the hotels, you know, these are jobs that, you know, anybody can have, you know, and especially when you talk about agriculture, nobody wants those jobs. My wife picked berries. She says the worst job she ever had, you know, so it's hard, hard work. And, you know, there's no reason that, and I think Trump Jr. had a great program, but then 9/11 happened, you know, but he wanted to have some kind of way where there was a way for workers to come in and out. And, there's a need there, you know, and if you hear their stories, they're humans, they're good people, they're not criminals, they're not thugs. Very, very few of them are. And matter of fact, the perfect example, you know, when you stand on a street corner and you see somebody that's homeless or begging for food, you rarely see a Latino person. Okay. And I'm not saying that because I'm Latino. Okay. but it's a pride thing because A, they have family members that'll take care of themselves, and B, they don't want handouts. Okay. They want to work. They don't want you just to give something. So if you just get to know them a little bit, you know, we're all human. We all have more in common. Yes, there might be a language barrier, but they're just good people. And that's what this country was built on.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, the other thing is, I don't know of white people who would do the work that immigrants do. I also know that multimillionaires and billionaires, they make money off the backs of immigrants, including Donald Trump, who, with his hotels and golf courses and other businesses, there's been a large immigrant population that has worked at his properties. What do you think that is the issue with folks? Is it that they're worried that they're going to take their jobs? Is that a real concern or fear, or do you think it's racism? Tell me what you think are some of the reasons why people in America either forget that they're immigrants themselves, or the offshoot of them, or that they just have such hate and disdain. What do you think some of those reasons are?
Yeah, and I would, or maybe I'm naive, but I don't feel that most Americans hate immigrants, okay? There's a small percentage of them that do. But I think it's a couple of things. Number one is, if your family immigrated here, you know, a couple hundred years ago, you know, so you're now 5 or 10 generations away. So I've seen this with, I mean, anytime I meet someone who's new to this country, they just have so much zeal and they see so many opportunities, and the work ethic they have is incredible. And then what happens is, 2 or 3 generations, as their kids and grandkids start growing up here, they almost become a little more entitled and they kind of lose that vibe, you know, and the edge, if you will. So I think that's part of it, is people just forget that they were immigrants at one time. I don't think most people want the jobs that the Latinos, and I'm not just speaking for the Latinos, but the immigrants, you know, whether it be the hotels, working in the farms and things like that. If they wanted those jobs, they could easily apply for them. But I also feel that part of the problem is our society. And I remember seeing, it was interesting, it was Bush and Reagan that were debating. And it was so interesting to see how different, as the Republicans, they were about immigration. And, you know, the thing is that, you know, take the construction industry. I mean, you look around, you throw a rock in any direction, 90% of the workers are Latino. Okay. Well, if you really investigate it, you know, since they sub out things to another sub and a sub and a sub, you know, a lot of these folks aren't even here illegally. So in some ways, we're subsidizing the cost of building that house. When you pay somebody less for picking those berries, you know, if there were true Americans picking those berries, can you imagine what strawberries would cost? You know, would people be willing to pay 5 or 6 times more? So in some ways, we're kind of feeding this system, you know, and I think, again, it goes back to just seeking to understand, you know, if you hear what these folks are doing and they're trying to make a difference. And I think there's a solution. You know, I have a friend who owns a farm here in the Gresham area, and he sends 3 buses down to Mexico every year. He packs them into the same village. They come here and he has housing for them. He feeds them. If they need banking needs, they make sure that they don't go to these cash stores. He takes care of them. They do great work. They work harder than anyone else. He'll be the first to tell you that. Then they go back home and then they do it again. You know, it's a win-win situation. So there's so many ways. It's not a black and white thing, but these jobs need to be done. And you see how many restaurants are closing right now. And a lot of it's because of staffing. It's just going to impact almost, unless you're the 2%, it's going to impact almost every business in some way. My wife's company just did some mass layoffs and she's losing her job. That was just announced this week. It was because of the tariffs. Everybody's being hurt by this one way or another.
Mm-hmm. I know that the support of the community is really important. It seemed like you did several events. You're doing events for Danny and Danny's family. Can you talk just a little bit about that? Like how you tried to rally up the community and, maybe what you learned from that process.
Yeah. You know, so it started since Danny and Mary's last business was in Lake Oswego, and it's still there, the Happy Sparrow. We thought that'd make the most sense. And we raised our son there. He went there from first grade to high school. So I have a lot of connections there. So that made the most sense to be the first event. And it was a great event. It was great turnout. There was over 100 people. We had K2 there. They had great footage. And is really our story was just telling the story, you know, about Danny's story. But more important to Danny and Mary is telling these other folks' stories and all these immigrants and how they're not criminals and thugs and how they're being treated. And there's not a single person after I tell a story. It can be the most MAGA person I know. When they hear this, it's like, wow, you know, because now they understand, you know, no, he's not a criminal thug. He was an 8-month-old baby when he came over here. You know, he had no choice. And you start hearing about all these little things where something could have gone left or right. And all it takes is a couple of turns going in a different direction and your whole life changes, you know? And I think when someone sees that and they know that, they empathize and they say, wow, you know, this is crazy. And that's what I'm just trying to do is plant seeds that look, this is a country of immigrants. All right. You know, go back a couple hundred years, however far it's been when your family came here, and think about it. Okay. Think about your first ancestors that came here. If they would have been here and all of a sudden just got uprooted, you know, or, you know, treated the way the immigrants are being treated. You know, these are humans. And that's the main thing that we're trying to say is this is not a political thing at all about Danny. This is basically a humanity thing. You know, let's treat people right. Let's not use a blanket statement and say all immigrants are criminals and thugs. All criminal immigrants have to be out of here. Let's look at the stories, you know, and yes, the criminals and thugs, Danny's the first one to admit those folks need to go. I think everybody agrees on that, but let's just try to take a more empathetic approach. So when I have these events and we've had, Danny was really into cars. We just had a car meet this weekend and had a good turnout. And we're going to keep doing that because again, for Danny to be exonerated to what happened in the past, we feel that we're going to have to wait till the next administration because you only get one chance to get exonerated. So they're fine going to Vietnam if that's where they end up. They rebuild their lives, and then I'm going to help them. I'm going to create a nonprofit. We're going to continue to raise awareness because that's the sad thing is there's so many stories that aren't being told. And I'll share one sad thing. You know, Danny talks to two or three people every week, and he shares these stories with me. And I say, Danny, get me a phone number, an email, a relative, somebody, you know? And I go, I'll find a translator, but we need to tell these stories. And this just breaks my heart because, again, my dad immigrated from Cuba, you know, and I didn't learn English till I was 5, like I said earlier. And it's like these immigrants don't want to tell their story because they're so scared that there's going to be repercussions against their family members. So they don't want to tell it, no, even though they're being treated poorly. And that's what just breaks my heart, you know? So again, it's just seeking to understand, you know, just asking questions and listening.
And if Danny were listening to you right now, what would you want him to hear from you or what would you say?
Oh, he says it every week, you know, that he's loved, you know, and respected and that he matters and his wife, Mary, and his two kids matter and that this is wrong, you know, and there's just no reason that he should be going through what he's going through, you know, and I'm just going to keep fighting for him. So he knows how I feel about him and he knows that he's loved by many, many other people. You know, they had an amazing event in Houston, you know, where a bunch of chefs and business owners did a barbecue for him. So if you met Dan and you knew him, you'd understand what I'm saying. He's just one of those guys, you know, that when you see him, he gives you a big hug and a smile. He's always optimistic. He's always smiling. And Mary's the same way too.
Wonderful. And how can people get involved that are listening if they want to, you know, donate, show up, share any of those things? What's the best way to get involved?
Yeah, I think the best way would be the website, which is freedom4danny.com, freedom4danny.com. And that will direct you to, we have a GoFundMe platform. I don't want folks to feel obligated to give, but if you go to the GoFundMe, it tells more of the story of what's happened, the chronology when Danny was growing up. We also have an Instagram page, you know, and a link to that also. And we try to update folks at least once a week, you know, so even if you give a dollar or whatever, it doesn't matter. But if you sign up, you know, to stay informed, that's a great way to hear about what's going on because we plan on keeping this going, even if they get deported to Vietnam. He wants to still tell these other folks' stories, and we're going to do a podcast and keep sharing the story because they just feel that it needs to be told.
Well, Al, thank you so much for doing this podcast and for being a good friend and a good community member. I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I it's funny because my wife and I were talking about it and someone said, oh, you're really a good friend. It's like, you know, there's not a good friend or a great friend. We're just friends, you know? And I like to think and hope that anybody would do this for a friend because imagine, you put yourself in Danny's shoes. You come here as an 8-month-old baby. You've been here for 50 years. You know, you have an 11 and a 9-year-old kid. You've been a business owner, paid taxes. You've been going to see the immigration folks twice a year with no problem. And then all of a sudden you're being deported to a country that yeah, he speaks the language, but he didn't grow up there. I mean, that's scary, man. And he's just taking it so well. And I just don't see how anybody, you know, wouldn't want to support a friend, you know? So if you see somebody who doesn't speak a language, you know, ask them, you know, learn their story. I mean, your folks, your grandparents somewhere down the line had a very similar story to these folks that you're seeing out here.
Hi, Mary. Thank you so much for doing this podcast.
Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that you and your family have been going through quite a bit. Can you tell us a little bit about when you first realized that Danny was going to be detained and what that looked like and felt like?
Well, this has been quite a tough season for us. Our family, we were very, very close. We were in Oregon for 15 years, and we didn't have any family. So it's always been just the four of us. And so him being away from us has been really, really difficult. The day it started, September 18th, which is almost 4 months now, we got a phone call, and I actually didn't think anything of it. I knew that he was going to his appointment, but he has been going to his these check-ins for as long as we've been together, and so and even before then. And so it was a routine check-in with immigration that he's had to do, and so we knew the chance of him getting detained, it was always a possibility, but something that we never really took seriously because of the fact that there were some things in place that offered him, we thought, quote unquote, protection. But with what Trump has been pushing, we were nervous, but there was a part of us that was hopeful that it wouldn't apply to Danny's case, because what Trump was, you know, speaking on were cases of those who were a threat to society, those who were causing, you know, like a lot of trouble to society. And Danny was not that person. Danny, yes, admittedly, he did get in some trouble when he was a teenager. He did have to serve some time, which he did complete, and he has been a great contribution to society. He hasn't caused any trouble. He was a teenager when these things happened. So him being 51 now, he, you know, has been a outstanding citizen for the past 30 so years without any maybe a speeding ticket. But other than that, he has not caused any trouble. He has not been in any trouble. He stayed clear of it. And so whenever Trump was talking about his immigration focus, Danny was not a target because he was not on that list of the people that Trump was saying that he was targeting. So when we got that phone call, I thought that he was joking. And he had to tell me very clearly and very seriously, this is not a joke. I have 2 minutes. They told me that they will be detaining me today and processing me for deportation. And then he proceeded to give me instructions on what I needed to do, the address they were going to be taking him to, and to you know, just not worry, but to let me know that this is happening. So yeah, life hasn't been the same since that phone call.
Yeah, thank you for sharing all that. Once you found out that he had been detained, of course you had to process that, but how did you explain it to family or community?
It was Danny has always been upfront and honest with his situation, with his immigration status. Just a quick, you know, background, some background information. In 94, he was charged for a case that he was innocent of. He tried to fight it. He went and got an attorney, hired his family, hired an attorney. They spent a good amount of money, and they were not able to get fair representation. The attorney ended up coercing him into signing. He was young at the time. His parents had already put out over $20,000 for 1994 for an immigrant family. That was a lot. And so Danny felt bad for putting him himself, his family into this situation. And so he decided to just go ahead and sign. He thought that he was still young. He still had the rest of his life. If he just basically just took the fall this time, he would be able to get out. And he knew that he only had good intentions, so he was not going to find himself anywhere close to any situation like this. So he'll just do the time now, and he has the rest of his life. In 97, 3 years later, while he was serving that sentence that he was innocent of, he was pulled out by immigration, and they said that they were revoking his green card, and they were putting him on the deportation list. And so he did try to try to fight that case in 97, but it was denied. When he was released in 2000, he was released with the clause of being having to check in, and I forget what the technical term is, but basically he has to check in frequently. And the check-in time ranged depending on the officer that assigned it whenever he went to go see. It could be 6 months. It got to the point where he was checking in every year, 18 months. So they were giving him a little bit more freedom of checking in. When we moved back from Oregon to Texas a year ago, he basically had to start over. So it was back to 6 months. So he checked in on February of 2025 and everything was fine. He checked in again September of 25, and that's whenever he was detained. So the news of us receiving the confirmation that he was actually detained and getting deported, the family members, close friends, and even not close friends, he was very open with his situation. Everybody was in shock because of the fact that they heard what Trump was trying to do, which was he was wrangling in the murderers, the hard criminals, the folks that were still causing trouble and not, they hadn't made any changes in their lives. So these were the people that we thought were being targeted. So whenever we found out that it was Danny, friends, family, they realized that what Trump was proclaiming was not actually truth. What he was saying that he was, who he was targeting, was actually not who he was really targeting. And he was basically targeting a vast majority of the people who were not actually in that category. And granted, we totally agree. If somebody is a menace to society, causing trouble, wreaking havoc, there's criminals that do need to be contained, detained, and removed. The big portion of the large portion of the folks that we're getting stories of from Danny and from others that are being detained are not those people. That's what we want to express, is we understand that there are criminals, that there are those who are causing a lot of damage to society here that do need to be removed. But the majority of the folks that we have interacted with, that Danny has interacted with in the ICE custody, are not those folks.
Well, and it sounds like he was detained doing exactly what he was told, which was to check in regularly. Is that what happened?
Yeah, he was detained, doing what he said that he would do and what he agreed to do. Most people now are running away. They are not checking in, which, I mean, human, you understand, if you had the choice, it would be hard to say, okay, you know what, I know what I'm signing up for and step up to it. Danny stepped up to it. He realized that there was a chance. He was hoping that it would not apply to him, but it turned out that it did apply to him. And he's always tried to do the right thing. And yes, when he was a teenager, he did make some poor choices. being a teenager. But since that time period of his life, he's always made sure to do the right thing. I mean, even to the point where he makes sure that I don't have any library books that are outstanding for the kids.
And when someone says, oh, you know, this is just the law, or this is just what should happen, what do you think they should understand about human cost of this? So it sounds like not only Danny being in the environment he's been in for 4 months, but you not having him as part of your family right now.
Yeah. And me, the kids, his parents, we moved back from Oregon. And Oregon was a beautiful, amazing place. That was home for us. We chose Oregon to be able to explore, because I knew his situation of not being able to leave America. I knew that he was limited to staying within America, the confines of America. So we decided to move to Oregon to explore the beauty, the nature, all the adventures that part of the country offered. And so to move back to Texas, it was a choice that Danny specifically made, because he wanted to be near family, to be able to help his parents out with his father's cancer. He became legally blind with the treatment. They treated him for the stage 4 brain cancer, and it was pretty harsh. And so he is now blind, so it limits him tremendously. So mom has to basically care for him completely on her own. So we wanted to come back and help, and we've been able to help. But now with the situation with Danny, it's definitely been a game changer, because now we need to reconsider everything, because we won't be here to help any longer. And so we're considering a lot of different situations. So yes, this has impacted us greatly, not just me as his wife, but the children. We have two children that miss their father greatly. They came back to Texas, which is not home to them now, it is, but they grew up in Oregon. So it's been an adjustment to get used to a new home. And now their father isn't with them here. So it's been difficult. And the whole idea of just us focusing on ourselves is impossible, because when we hear the stories of all the other detainees from Danny's side, whenever he shares the stories of the other detainees in there, it makes our situation seem trivial compared to the others. And we have to be thankful that we have family, that we have friends that care, that we have a voice, that we have an opportunity to share, like with you, Michael. And we appreciate that so very much. So we thank you for allowing us to be a voice for not just our story, but for all the other stories of this situation that we see in America right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And how beautiful of a thing for you to be experiencing this, but also think about the others as well. You know, you've spoken about the conditions in the ICE detention facilities. Yeah. Can you talk more about that? Like, has Danny talked to you about how he's treated on a daily basis and what that looks like?
It's been hard. I think he is, I know that he is shielding me from all the details. He doesn't want for me to worry. He doesn't want his mom to worry. He doesn't want the kids to worry. So he doesn't want to share everything. But what he has shared, they do not treat the detainees very well. They could, but it seems like they just choose not to. When he first arrived in there, he asked for a blanket, because they keep it very, very cold for whatever reason, like very ridiculously cold in there. And he just shivers to bed many nights, and he's asked for a blanket, and it's taken them, you know, like a long time to fulfill requests. They get very skimpy meals. The meals are basically beans, watered down beans. He basically is not not happy there. And I can understand not just the fact that he's not with us, but the conditions, they do not make it very pleasant for the detainees. In order to make any requests, you have to constantly request. And we've asked for updates. We don't know a date. We don't have any details as to his situation. Like I said, it's coming on 4 months now. And with habeas corpus, I believe that's what it is. They have 90 days to proceed with whatever it is that they're going to do, whatever act they're going to do. And it's been over the 90 days, and we still have not heard a single thing about what is going to happen with Danny. No dates, no updates or anything. We did get notification from his family in Vietnam that will be sponsoring him, because for them to transfer over, there's certain stipulations. And one is that he has to have a sponsor in Vietnam. And so his aunt will be that person for him. And she did notify us about 3 weeks ago that the Vietnamese government has reached out to her to verify information. And we were hopeful that that meant that he would be released soon. But we still haven't heard anything from the American side of.
When was the last time that he lived in Vietnam? I mean, this is decades ago, right?
Decades and decades ago, Michael. He was born in Vietnam, but he was born in 74, and the fall of Vietnam happened April of 75. So when he came over, he was just a baby. And so it was, Vietnam is, it's just, he hears it in stories. Thankfully, now we do have social media so we can actually see and visualize. But for his whole life, he's lived here. So he doesn't know of any other home. He counts himself as American, although he realizes that he's never had the citizenship. But he grew up here. He knows America. He loves America. He's brokenhearted to have to leave. In his situation, it is unique because he's always known that that was something that was possible. But he did also always feel that he was protected because he came over as a refugee under asylum after the war, because their family left right after the war, like that very night when the government took over, the North government took over. And so they've always they've always known that that's the reality. And it's been more difficult because of the situation with Vietnam. Many of the refugees, their families that remained behind, including Danny's, they got rid of all the paperwork because of harassment from the government, because those who left and fled were considered traitors. And so for protection, his grandfather had gotten rid of all of the documents, all any evidence that Danny and his parents and his family existed. And so now we're having to try and prove to the Vietnamese government Danny's citizenship, or that the fact that he was born in Vietnam. And so it's just like a weird situation. And Vietnam is one of the countries. America marketed itself to be a country that welcomes refugees, the foreigners, those who were desperate and having to leave countries. Vietnam is, our country. Vietnam is our experience, but there are many other experiences. And now it's turned around where all of these folks who came to America for refuge and for a better life, for a better, for a future, and now they're being rejected. And so it's a complex situation. Vietnam has never seen itself in this position. So I understand it's taking a little bit longer because of all the paperwork that they are having to go through and having to connect the dots when the dots had been erased, basically, on their side.
Yeah. Well, and also a lot of people say that, like you mentioned earlier, criminals are the worst of the worst. People also think these are people who are not working or not paying taxes. Can you take a moment and kind of dispel, that who you and Danny are as people and sort of your place in American society?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to explain that. When we were in Oregon, we actually had a business up there. We owned a bakery coffee shop for 15 years called the Happy Sparrow Cafe. And we had the most amazing supporters, our fan base, or they were the best. And we had 15 years of experience there, seeing families grow. We were able to experience so much love, and we basically were a part of the community and a part of a couple of different neighborhoods because we moved from one location to the other. And we were so grateful for the opportunity. And many of those patrons became friends, and from friends, basically family to us, because like I said earlier, we didn't have family up there. And so God did bless us with amazing people that became our chosen family. So we are very, very thankful. We had 15 years there, and if it weren't for the need to come back to help out with Danny's father's health situation, we would have stayed there and not have left at all, because we loved Oregon so much. We loved our community there. We love being a part of it. We love watching it grow, and we miss it dearly. But yes, we're a contributing part of society. We tried our best to offer and inject positivity and just a better spirit and a better way of living. The name of our shop was called the Happy Sparrow, and so that kind of gives you an idea of what our brand was about, what our values were, and what our ethos were with what how we conducted business. And on that note, we understand this is not what we would choose for ourselves, for our family. But we do trust that God has a plan. Whatever it is, we are in His hands, and we will continue to be who He designed us to be. We want to add value everywhere we go. So if we do end up going back to Vietnam, we'll bring those same values, and we will just do our best with what we're given, and make do with what we have, make lemonade out of lemons, basically. So we enjoyed our time in Oregon greatly. We miss everything about our life there, and we appreciate every moment, every person, and we did our best to tried to plant good, positive seeds, and we hope that we did. And as we move forward to wherever it is that we end up going, it does seem like it will be Vietnam once we finally get a date for Danny to be free and released. Then that's where we will continue to spread our hope and joy there. So it is hard to try and stay positive in the situation that we're facing. Like I said, that phone call, everything changed from that moment on. And it's been, it's been a lot of figuring things out, facing a lot of unknowns, and being in a constant state of limbo while you're trying to figure out the next steps and maintaining current life and all the balls that are in the air. It's been difficult, but we have the support of our loved ones, of our friends, of our family, and even complete strangers. Michael, I so appreciate, like I said, that you invite me here on your platform to share my story and to share what's going on. And we definitely appreciate you giving us a voice.
Well, it looks like we've reached the end of this episode of All American Why. If you made it this far, congratulations. You're officially an excessive thinker, too. If something today made you laugh, cringe, or reconsider everything you thought you understood about this country, good. Well, that's the point. Subscribe, rate, review, and share All American Why wherever you get your podcasts, including on YouTube. Or don't. It's still a free country. For now, you can find me, Michael Jonas, on social media or at allamericanwhy.com. where we're building a community for people who still give a damn. Original music by Renazra and Views. Audio editing by Kyle Gilmore of Residual Audio. Until next time, keep your curiosity loud, your optimism spiteful, and your democracy under constant surveillance. This is All American Why. Thanks for listening.
American why. Ask yourself the American why. All American why.